This is Donna Reed reading you with you today, January 17th, Friday. We're looking at the Pantagraph. Let's start on the first page with an interesting story. Spirits linger. Alcohol ban's legacy still shapes U.S. politics, culture. This is by Dave Crary out of New York. In this era of bottomless mimosas, craft beers, and ever-present happy hours, it's striking to recall that 100 years ago, the United States imposed a nationwide ban on the production and sale of all types of alcohol. The Prohibition era, which lasted from January 17, 1920, until December 1933, is now viewed as a failed experiment that glamorized illegal drinking. But there are several intriguing parallels in current times. Americans are consuming more alcohol per capita now than in the time leading up to Prohibition, when alcohol opponents successfully made the case that excessive drinking was ruining family life. More states are also moving to decriminalize marijuana, with legalization backers frequently citing Prohibition's failures. Many of the same speakeasy locations operating in the 1920s are flourishing in a culture that romanticizes the era. And in a time of heightened racial divisions, Prohibition offers a poignant history lesson on how the restrictions targeted blacks and recent immigrants more harshly than other communities. That treatment eventually propelled many of those marginalized Americans into the Democratic Party, which engineered Prohibition's repeal. Prohibition had a lot of unintended consequences that backfired on the people who worked so hard to establish the law, said Harvard history professor Lisa McGeer, whose 2015 book, The War on Alcohol, examines Prohibition's political and social repercussions. It helped to reactivate and enfranchise men and women who had been part of the political process, she said. That was not the intention of Prohibition supporters. Ratification of the 18th Amendment in 1919, which set the stage for Prohibition's launch a year later, culminated a century of advocacy by the temperance movement. Leading forces including the Women's Christian Temperance Union, the Anti-Saloon League, and many Protestant denominations. Prohibition supporters assailed the impact of booze on families and the prominent role that saloons played in immigrant communities. Prohibition greatly expanded federal law enforcement powers and turned millions of Americans into scofflaws. It provided a new revenue stream for organized crime. By the time the constitutional amendment was ratified in January 1919, many states had enacted their own prohibition laws. That October, Congress passed a law detailing how the federal government would enforce prohibition. It was known as the Volstead Act in recognition of its foremost champion, Representative Andrew Volstead of Minnesota. The law banned the manufacture, sale, and transport of any intoxicating liquor, beverages with an alcohol content of more than 0.5%, including beer and wine. Statistically, prohibition was not an utter failure. Deaths from alcohol-related cirrhosis declined, as did arrests for public drunkenness. What the statistics don't measure is how extensively prohibition was flouted. Bootleggers established vast distribution networks. Makers of moonshine and bathtub gin proliferated, sometimes producing fatally tainted liquor. Determined drinkers concealed their contraband in hip flasks or hollowed-out canes. Maryland refused to pass a law enforcing the Volstead Act. McSorley's Old Ale House, established in New York in 1854 and still flourishing as one of the city's oldest bars, never closed during Prohibition. Ostensibly, it served near beer, with permissible low alcohol content, but in fact produced a strong ale from a makeshift brewery erected in the basement. "It wasn't a near beer. It was McSorley's ale," said the pub's manager, Gregory de la Haba. At least once a week, people would ask, "What did we do during Prohibition?" And my reply is, "We made a ton of money." The federal government, as well as state and local authorities, spent huge sums on enforcement, yet never allocated sufficient resources to do the job effectively. Bootleggers, awash in cash, bribed judges, politicians, and law enforcement officers to let their operations continue. Newly hired and poorly trained prohibition agents, along with local and state police, targeted violators at the margins, McGreer wrote in a recent article. But they lacked the capacity and at times the will to go after powerful crime kingpins. It's simplistic to say Prohibition created organized crime in America, but it fueled a huge expansion as local crime gangs collaborated with those from other regions to establish shipping systems and set prices for bootlegged alcohol. Beneficiaries included Chicago-based gangster Al Capone, who earned tens of millions of dollars annually from bootlegging and speakeasies. In the infamous St. Valentine's Day Massacre in 1929, gunmen disguised as police officers killed seven men from a gang that sought to compete with Al Capone. Beyond the ranks of gangsters, legions of Americans were committing or abetting crime. Michael Lerner, in his book Dry Manhattan, Prohibition in New York City, says courtrooms and jails were so overwhelmed that judges began accepting plea bargains, making it a common practice in American jurisprudence for the first time. Anti-immigrant sentiment was a key factor behind Prohibition, partly because of record high immigration in the preceding decades. Saloons in immigrant neighborhoods were prime targets, says Slippery Rock University history professor Aaron Cohen, because middle-class white Protestants viewed them as political and social danger zones. Often the political machines run by the bosses were based in these saloons or used them as a conduit for extending favors, Cohen said. So there was concern about political corruption, changing social values, immigrants learning radical politics. Prohibition start in 1920 coincided with a major expansion of the Ku Klux Klan, which supported the ban on alcohol as it waged its anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, and racist activities. The Volstead Act provided a way for the Klan to legitimize its 100% Americanist mission. It could target the drinking of those they perceived to be their enemies, McGreer said. Let's continue here on January 17th as we look at the front page and a local article that is in keeping with the main article we just read. Prohibition left ripples in the Twin Cities. This is by Kevin Barlow out of Bloomington. Loretta Gent took a stand against alcohol before she even knew much about it, signing a pledge when joining the Illinois Woman's Christian Temperance Union decades ago. The resident of Normal made a promise which she still honors today. By the help of God and a WCTU pledge I signed when I had just turned 12 years old, I had never had a drink of alcohol. I am so thankful that I have been spared even the possibility of becoming an alcoholic and all of the other negative effects of alcohol. The Illinois WCTU was founded in Bloomington in 1874 with the aim of promoting total abstinence from alcohol. As members, women pledged total abstinence from all intoxicating liquors as a beverage. They worked to change local, state, and national laws, educate youths and others, and provide social pressure for promoting the cause of total abstinence. Shadows of that legacy remain apparent today. The WCTU chapter remains active. Goodfield just went wet in 2018, and Normal was dry for almost 40 years. Normal ordinances still forbid bars, but allow restaurants to sell liquor. The recently opened Bakery and Pickles restaurant in downtown Bloomington has a speakeasy theme with a password required for entrance to the dining room and the bar area. In the days of Prohibition, a Bloomington man, Sam Capshaw, was well known to law enforcement and those wanting to buy illegal booze. Candace Summers, Director of Education in the McLean County Museum of History, believes Capshaw was the only local person to be killed as a result of activities associated with illegal alcohol delivery or possession during that era. I didn't think that McLean County would be a typical area with a lot of bootleggers and rum runners, said Summer, but I was wrong. According to Pantograph Archives, on December 27, 1928, Capshaw, known in police annals as a bootlegger, refused to sell a pint of liquor to Henry Mendina. The laborer pulled a gun and shot Capshaw dead. He led police on a 15-minute chase, but pulled the gun on himself before he could be placed under arrest. Capshaw is buried at Park Hill Cemetery in Bloomington. We didn't have mobs here like Al Capone or the Sheldon Gang, but actually there were some Sheldons who did a little bit of stuff up here, Summers said. But there wasn't a big organized crime ring. There were a lot of enterprising people who decided to make a living by doing a lot of illegal activities. McLean County residents found plenty of places to drink, such as the Shady Nook at the Bloomington Normal border on Jersey Avenue, the Mountain House on West Market Street, the Alhambra in downtown Bloomington, and the Nighthawk on Lumber Street. Other Bloomington sites included the Royal Palm Social Club on West Market and the Nomad Club, known as the rowdiest bar in town. In one raid, Sheriff J.E. Morrison and his crew carried illegal alcohol from a storeroom to a sewer, where 1,020 gallons of liquor, some described as good, some as bad, and some as real dynamite, was emptied into a sewer. Prohibition ended on all alcohol in 1933. Residents in Normal voted to return to dry status in 1935, and the town remained dry until 1973. Let's continue with some local and state news from page 3 of the Pantograph this day, January 17th. Suspect loses hospital access, out of Bloomington. Bloomington Normal's two hospitals suspended privileges to practice medicine on Thursday of a Bloomington orthopedic surgeon accused of a sexual assault and abuse. Meanwhile, Sean Kink posted bond Thursday and was released from McLean County Jail, and a colleague who called the charges shocking said Kink is on personal leave. Kink, 34, of the 5,000 block of Longfield Road, is charged with aggravated criminal sexual assault, aggravated criminal sexual abuse, and criminal sexual abuse, according to McLean County court documents. The charges allege that on December 5th in Bloomington, he committed a sexual act using force or the threat of force with an adult victim who has a physical disability. The charges did not specify whether the allegations were related to his work. Kink was arrested Wednesday afternoon on a warrant. His bond was set at $200,000 with 10% to apply. He posted $20,035 to be released Thursday, according to court documents. We are saddened by the recent news and take the allegations seriously, said Libby Allison, Media Relations Coordinator with OSF Healthcare. Our thoughts and prayers are with everyone involved. Dr. Kink, an independent physician, is currently on leave from the medical staff at OSF Healthcare, St. Joseph Medical Center. Kink's privileges to practice medicine have been suspended at Advocate Broman Medical Center in Normal, pending the outcome of the case, said Lynn Hutley, Advocate Aurora Health Regional Coordinator of Public Affairs. Kink is an orthopedic surgeon with McLean County's Orthopedics MCO, which is based in Bloomington. I am not aware of this allegation involving a patient, MCO Vice President Dr. Jerry Oakey told the Pantograph on Thursday. He said he knew nothing of the allegations other than the charges that police released publicly Wednesday night. While Kink remains affiliated with MCO, he is on a personal leave at this point, Oakey said. We have contacted his patients who need immediate follow-up care and placed them with the most appropriate MCO provider, Oakey said. He called the allegations against Kink shocking and saddening. Kink has no other criminal or civil record on file in the McLean County Circuit Clerk's office and no history of disciplinary orders filed against his medical license, according to all state records. Town budget status quo. Let's look at this story. Out of Normal, the Normal City Council received its first look at the staff-prepared spending plan for the fiscal year beginning April 1st during an all-day budget work session Thursday in council chambers at Uptown Station. The proposed budget is a little over $136 million, said Finance Director Andrew Hune. That's about 9% more than the original budget for the current fiscal year, ending March 31, 2020, which was almost $129 million, and about 3% less than the estimated final budget for the current fiscal year, which was almost $141 million, Hune said. We are defining the budget as status quo as far as operations, said City Manager Pam Reese. We are expecting a relatively status quo revenue stream. We are proposing no increase or budget reduction in services, and no new positions beyond what the council has approved, she continued. The council in December approved $96,834 for a town communications specialist, a position the town has gone without for about 2 years. We don't anticipate filling that position until after April, Reese said. The town has 377 employees, and beyond the communications specialist, the town anticipates adding just a few part-time positions to support operations, Reese said. For non-union employees, the town is budgeting merit increases of 2.5% and a cost of living increase of 1.5%, Hune said. Later this month, the town will start collective bargaining with police and firefighters, Reese said. The town water rates are projected to increase 2% on April from a 6.57 from $6.57 per 1,000 gallons to $6.70 per 1,000 gallons, while the per month system maintenance fee will increase from $5.99 to $6.11. Town sewer rates will increase from $2.44 per 1,000 gallons to $3.50 per month system maintenance fee to $2.65 per 1,000 gallons plus a $3.75 per month system maintenance fee. All that money is invested back into the water and sewer systems, they said. Garbage and recycling collection rates will increase from $26 a month to $30 a month on April 1st. The town is proposing some program increases, including in some Ironwood golf fees, The aquatic season pass from $45 to $50. Before and after school program fees. And adult softball and soccer fees. A daily pass for the Children's Discovery Museum increased by $1 on January 1st. The town is projecting $800,000 more in motor fuel tax monies because of the state gas tax increase. And all that money will go to road work, Reese said. Projected cannabis sales tax revenue is not included in the proposed budget because we don't know what the sales are going to be, Reese said, adding the budget is conservative when it comes to projecting revenue. The budget projects a 1.5% increase in sales taxes. There are several reasons why Normal is spending more money for the fiscal year ending March 31st than originally budgeted, Hune and Reese explained. The town refinanced some debt at a lower rate. Some capital projects, primarily road work, that had been planned to be done last fiscal year will be done this fiscal year. And the town reclassified how it records pension contributions for police and fire from a transfer out to an actual expense, they said. The property tax rate for property taxes payable in 2020 will be $1.4633 per 100 equalized assessed valuation compared to $1.4706 per 100 EAV in 2019. The owner of a $165,000 house is projected to pay $721.62 for the normal portion of their property tax bill, compared with $720.53 last year. The town's total debt will be $85.7 million on March 31st. We manage our debt portfolio very closely, Reese said. Our debt is going to be paid off in 21 years. Any changes approved by the council will be programmed into the proposed budget, which will return to the council for its fiscal approval in March. And let's finish out some page 3 news here in local and state with this story out of Bloomington. Spring Bloom Art Event canceled again. The Spring Bloom Fine Arts Festival will not be back in 2020 because of a decline in artists' interest in participating. Last year, the festival took a hiatus because the renovation of the Illinois State University Ballroom couldn't guarantee that we would have the space available, said Doug Johnson, executive director of the McLean County Arts Center, which sponsors the annual event. Without the consistency of the year-to-year event, we didn't get the applications this year to support resuming the event, he said. The Arts Center board is discussing whether to continue the event in future years, said Johnson. We have really liked having a spring festival and supporting the artists, he said. We've gotten a good response from the community, but at this point, we really want to make the best decision for both the organization and the artists. The artists who participated in the Spring Festival, typically held in mid-March, also participate in the Art Center's Sugar Creek Arts Festival, held every summer in Uptown Normal. They come from all over the Midwest, said Johnson. So it can be problematic for them because Spring Bloom is a one-day event and they're having to drive 8 hours for the event. But it had always been popular because it was a bit of a launch of the season for artists as they began the festival circuit. Spring Bloom started about 15 years ago in the unfinished ballroom at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Moved to the Sale Barn for 7 seasons until that venue closed, and then used the Interstate Center before finally settling at ISU. Because of the size of ISU's Brown Ballroom in the Bone Student Center, the number of artists participating in the Spring Arts Festival was capped at 70, said John. Let's look at some Today in History facts. Today is Friday, January 17th, the 17th day of 2020. There are 349 days left in the year. On this date, in 1806, Thomas Jefferson's daughter Martha gave birth to James Madison Randolph, the first child born in the White House. On January 17, 1995, more than 6,000 people were killed when an earthquake with a magnitude of 7.2 devastated the city of Kobe, Japan. In 1916, the Professional Golfers Association of America had its beginnings as department store magnate Rodman Wanamaker hosted a luncheon of pro and amateur golfers in New York City. The PGA of America was formally established on April 10, 1916. In 1917, Denmark ceded the Virgin Islands to the United States for $25 million. Thought for today? The only thing wrong with immortality is that it tends to go on forever. So let's continue. Here's a little section in the pantograph called How Time Flies. 100 years ago, today, 1920, the winner of the Downstate Checker Championship is C.P. Boso of Bloomington. The tournament was held at the Cooksville Community Hall. Plans are now in the works for Boso to square off against McLean County champion W.A. Craig in the near future. 75 years ago today, January 17, 1945, the new post office substation has opened at Lauer's Pharmacy, 222 West Jefferson Street. Patrons can get all types of mail service connected with the sending of letters, cards, parcel post, and registered mail. 50 years ago, January 17, 1970, three people were killed in a head-on collision on a country road about half a mile west of Downs. Dead are an Illinois Wesleyan student and his passenger, both 20, and a Farmer City man, the driver of the second car. And 25 years ago, in 1995 on this date, an ISU quarterback's football career abruptly ended when he was hit by a slow-moving freight train near the Normal Business District. He was apparently running along the train tracks to eventually get around it, but slipped. He lost his right foot in that accident. Well, this has been Donna Reed talking to you today, January 17th, reading with the pantograph. We'll take a short break and we'll get back to part two, read the obituaries, and look at some more news. Thanks for joining me.